You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The hedge fund Amaranth Advisors had more than $9 billion in assets at its peak. A few weeks later, it completely collapsed. That disaster was caused by one risky trader, Brian Hunter, whose bets on natural gas prices bankrupted his firm. Meanwhile, his rival, John Arnold of Centaurus, which is a competing fund, emerged as the highest paid trader on Wall Street. In her new book, Hedgehogs, Barbara T. Dreyfus tracks the colliding paths of these two traders who dominated the speculative energy market. In doing so, she gives us an inside view of the world of hedge funds. The book is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings Barbara T. Dreyfus to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Isn't your background unusual for someone who winds up on Wall Street? Didn't you have a master's degree in social work?
Well, I did study sociology and psychology at Barnard and started out as a social worker. But because I worked in a number of hospitals, I ended up doing health policy, and that ultimately led to the job on Wall Street.
Well, it seems to me having a degree and knowing something about psychology might actually help you to understand what goes on at Wall Street. So you had this job as a newsletter that discussed government health policy, and that led to an offer from Prudential Beach?
Correct. I was a Washington health policy analyst. So I followed developments on Capitol Hill, FDA, government agencies, Congress, related to health care.
And that was a while back. Was Wall Street a very different entity at the time?
Wall Street was quite different at that point. The people that I dealt with at that time were mostly the mutual funds and money managers, some of the banks. These were, by and large, long-term investors. So they also operated from the view that they should understand the companies that they were investing in, the products they were investing in. And the health policy in Washington impacted that quite a bit. So that's where I came in. They wanted to know what was coming out from Congress, from the agencies, that would impact long-term health policy.
So they could make informed decisions.
Exactly.
And at that time, there was no internet, or at least it was barely an internet. There was no 24-hour news feed. CNN was brand new. Were the investors you dealt with pressured to make immediate decisions on investments nonetheless?
Not really. They did have time to think about what they were doing because they were investing in a product or a company's growth. They were much more like Warren Buffett at that point.
Were the healthcare companies that you studied worried about their stock prices, as they obviously are today? Was there any withholding of information in those days?
I think when I started, not so much. I think that changed pretty dramatically when CEOs and others at companies started to get stock as part of their compensation. And then suddenly, and it was pretty sudden to me anyway, they really got concerned first on a quarterly basis and then even more frequent basis about what was happening to their stocks. And you ultimately see that with Enron and WorldCom because at that point for those companies, stock prices and how they were doing was the ultimate importance.
And Enron does come into this story. But yes. At the time you were there, mutual funds were the big thing, weren't they?
Mutual fund investing was the big area. These were our clients. And they mostly wanted to see stock prices go up. They were investing long term. And the companies were happy to have that kind of review by mutual funds.
When did you start getting calls from hedge funds?
In the 90s, there were some hedge funds. And
well, hedge funds predated the 90s, didn't they?
Yes, there were some in the 80s. I mean, the first hedge fund was 1949. But there were really a small number of them, and they had trouble in the 70s. Someone had a business. In the 80s, there were a handful. They were some of the well-known names, Soros, Tiger Management. These earlier hedge funds were started by seasoned traders. They focused on certain areas of investment that they knew well. And I always felt they were the smartest people on Wall Street.
But they also served the truly wealthy, didn't they? Unlike mutual funds, which were much more democratic.
Hedge funds were structured to avoid various regulations. And to do that, they had to be sold only to the wealthy, basically millionaires.
You mentioned that it was created in 1947 by a man named A.W. Jones, who had a background that would not suggest that he ever would have wound up on Wall Street.
Right. He was a social worker.
I see a link here.
He wrote about the Civil War in Spain. He wanted to set up an investment service, mostly for his friends who were artists, social workers, painters, like people like him. And so he wanted to make them money, but protect their money as well. So he wanted to hedge his bets or his investments, and hence the name hedge fund.
He had worked at Fortune magazine, or at least Time Inc.
Yes.
And that's what got him into it. Now, hedging your bets is the sort of thing that bookies talk about. Are hedge funds in any way related to bookmaking?
Well, there's some similarity there, I would say. I think the way they operate today, it's really a big casino.
Now, he, A.W. Jones, figured out how hedge funds could avoid the restrictions of the Securities Act of 1933. And that has been a key to their success, hasn't it?
Right. They're basically not regulated. And that's because they do what they have to do to avoid those regulations. The main thing they need to do is not market publicly widespread to the ordinary population. So they're limited to millionaires. If their clients are millionaires, they really avoid most of the regulations.
So if I were a millionaire, a friend of mine might very well suggest to some hedge fund that they take me on.
Right.
My guest is Barbara T. Dreyfus. Her latest book, Hedgehogs, The Cowboy Traders Behind Wall Street's Largest Hedge Fund Disaster. How are hedge funds different from other kinds of investment funds otherwise? You say they don't have the kind of regulations. Do their fund managers differ from other kinds of managers? Or could I, if you've been a manager of a mutual fund, would it be an easy transition to move over to hedge funds?
I think that's one of the problems that happened after the collapse in 2000-2001. We're talking about the tech bubble burst. And a lot of mutual fund managers set up hedge funds. And that's when you had the big growth in the hedge funds. Thousands started.
Because hedge funds had done well at, despite the crash? Or they had survived anyway?
Yeah, they had survived. Some had done okay. But they were promising, particularly pensions and other clients of mutual funds, hey, invest with us. We can make you money if the market goes up or if it goes down. And pensions, endowments had been very hurt by the tech bubble bursting in 2000-2001. They were looking for some place to invest their money. And at that point in time, a lot of mutual fund managers decided to set up hedge funds. And that's when you got the pensions, the endowments, the insurance companies looking at hedge funds as an investment potential.
What is the fee structure of hedge funds?
That's one of the biggest differences between mutual funds and hedge funds. A hedge fund will take a fee. Usually it's 2% of the assets under management goes to the fund, the hedge fund manager. And they take 20% of any profits they make, which is a tremendous incentive for hedge fund managers to take huge risks.
But also suggests to somebody who wants to get a lot of money that they're being handled by somebody who benefits when they benefit.
That's the argument they make.
But weren't they considered fairly risky investments by rich people until the crash of 2000?
I think they were always considered risky, but I think what happened is the crash in 2000-2001 showed people that even the stock market can tank it.
Well, was it possible for hedge funds to manipulate the news to move prices? Haven't they been accused of that, manipulating markets?
Jim Cramer had a very revealing piece on one of his internet shows where he used to be a hedge fund manager, and he talked about how easy it was if he wanted to move a stock down and it was going up and he had invested as though it were going to go down, how easy it was for him to spread news among various media, to call various banks and traders and tell them he heard various reports about the stock going down. And he described in great detail how easy it is, if you want, to actually turn a stock from one moving up to one moving down. I often felt when I got calls from hedge fund managers with some wild story they were telling me about something that really didn't seem to have any relationship to what I knew, that they were trying to plant a story on me so that I would in turn go out with that story and help their stock cause, so to speak.
You would publish it, and today with the Bloomberg and such, even a rumor, it can cause major fluctuations.
Absolutely. That's what hedge funds really wanted from me. As the numbers of hedge funds grew and the timing of their investments shortened to days and minutes, they just wanted to hear rumors and stories because that moved a price very quickly.
In some banks, weren't the analysts compromised by the relationship with the in-house investment bankers?
That was a big problem, of course, around 2000-2001. Elliot Spitzer investigated. The analysts wanted to see the stock prices go up because they wanted the banking business. And ironically, hedge funds at that point were the one area in the marketplace that was willing to hear and discuss negative news.
Now, your book portrays two competing traders, Brian Hunter and John Arnold, who traded natural gas. Is that done by means of options?
It could be. That's one way. You can actually buy contracts that represent natural gas amounts, but it's paper.
Well, you write a contract agreeing to buy or sell natural gas at a given price sometime in the future. Mm-hmm. The worst thing that could happen is that you actually get delivery of the product.
Right. That actually happened at the hedge fund that I wrote about, not by the trader that I wrote about, but before he got there. They actually bought some natural gas futures contracts. The idea is you're supposed to get rid of those contracts before they come due. Something went wrong. They ended up with these contracts, and they were about to get a delivery on their doorstep someplace, I don't know where, of natural gas. So they scrambled and scrambled, and they were lucky they were able to get out of it at the last minute, but that's a big issue.
You could be stuck with a lot of natural gas selling at a loss.
Yeah. If you have to trade under that pressure, you lose money.
My guest is Barbara T. Dreyfus. Her book, Hedge Hogs, The Cowboy Traders Behind Wall Street's Largest Hedge Fund Disaster. It's published by Random House. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Barbara Dreyfus. Her book, Hedge Hogs, The Cowboy Traders Behind Wall Street's Largest Hedge Fund Disaster, published by Random House. So let's get back to these two traders, Brian Hunter and John Arnold. What kinds of analysis go into the decision they make as to whether to buy or sell natural gas at a given price sometime in the future?
These two traders are speculators. They are not people who use natural gas. They're not producers of natural gas. They're not utilities that need it. They're not people who buy for schools and hospitals that use the natural gas. So they are just interested in making money on the buying and selling of natural gas.
Do the traders have to make guesses about things like what the weather will be at any given time in the future?
Yes, because what they're interested in is the price of natural gas currently, in the future, in different parts of the country. And so they are looking at things that go into affecting that price.
It's changed the whole atmosphere of Wall Street, hasn't it? And Wall Street began to hire math majors instead of business majors.
Right. Quants. And in natural gas trading, what you have is people who do calculations on this month's price of gas versus next month's price of gas, how that was in the past, projected into the future. And so the actual idea of natural gas as an entity that you use and how it's impacted by supply and demand somewhat recedes from the equation here.
When did Myron Scholes and Fisher Black develop what became known as the Black-Scholes model for option pricing? And what does it do?
That was the key for option pricing. Before you had that formula, people were loath to actually buy options. Let me just say what an option is. It's the right to buy or sell a contract of something, a commodity, for example, in the future at a set price. But it gives you the right to do it. It doesn't mean you
commit you to it.
Right. So based on how the price moves, you decide if you're going to actually do it, exercise the option.
But doesn't somebody else also have the right to make that option? So are you competing with other people who are optioning something? Or?
Well, you might be buying from them or selling to them or competing with them.
Brian Hunter majored in physics at the University of Alberta in Canada. So how did he become involved in finance?
He was also a very skilled mathematician. So I think his mathematical side led him into options pricing and in turn trading.
So the rise of the quants on Wall Street played a role in the direction his life took, but also the deregulation of natural gas in North America.
Right.
Why was it deregulated? Why and how had it been regulated, I guess, should have been the question.
Before the 80s, natural gas was totally regulated in price, and structure of sale. The government set the price at the wellhead. The price was in turn set with the pipelines. So there was no give and take on the price, and you had no trading of natural gas at that point. I think Enron was a key force in getting natural gas deregulated. Ken Lay, the head of Enron, was a very strong advocate for deregulation. He organized other gas pipeline companies to help him do that, and Enron was pretty powerful on Capitol Hill.
Because they had political connections.
Correct.
And John Arnold, one of the two people you write about here, worked at Enron.
He was their key top natural gas trader and earned quite a lot of money for Enron. He did not trade the actual physical product. He only traded the paper contracts representing natural gas. And I think his last year at Enron, 2001, he made something like $750 million for them,
wow,
which at the time was money.
But he left before the crash, before everything caved in on Enron.
No, he actually was there then, and he had made so much money that year for Enron that he expected a huge bonus the next year. And in fact, after Enron's collapse and bankruptcy, a number of the traders, including Arnold, did get bonuses. He got the largest bonus, $8 million. And employees of Enron were so outraged at this that they sued all the other traders who had gotten bonuses and ultimately won that money back. Arnold had already settled and given back a lot of his money.
Well, how important was trading at Enron? Didn't they, weren't they in the business of delivering gas?
That's what they started out doing. But Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling soon learned that trading natural gas, as opposed to actually delivering it or buying the actual physical product, trading was much more lucrative.
But it sounds to me like this lends itself to manipulation of the markets and natural gas if you're both trading and supplying.
Well, Enron had a lot of lawsuits against it, and as did the other merchant energy companies. Enron, of course, the biggest scandal there was the electricity market, buying and selling it, manipulating the price.
And causing a lot of trouble for California.
Right.
This Texas and California is still fighting, but it seems to me this was the beginning of that fight. My guest is Barbara T. Dreyfus. Her book, Hedgehogs, The Cowboy Traders Behind Wall Street's Largest Hedge Fund Disaster, published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The other trader, Brian Hunter, began working in Canada for a company called TransCanada. Was that like Enron?
It was similar. It was the largest pipeline company in Canada, but they didn't do the kind of energy trading that Enron did, because the CEO of TransCanada actually said, "We're spending an awful lot of money on this trading and we're not making money," and ultimately got them out of trading just when Brian Hunter left. They were not the cowboy traders that Enron was.
So Brian Hunter came to New York and worked for Deutsche Bank. And at first he was successful for them.
Yes, he made a lot of money trading natural gas for them. They expanded his role. But he wasn't satisfied with either the amount he was trading or the amount he was paid.
Well, you say that there were months when his estimate of his profit was off to his benefit by numbers like $7 million. Was he just playing with the numbers?
His boss took a look at that and grew concerned. At that time, it was up to the trader to give an estimate of what the worth of your holdings was. And his boss was very concerned that the numbers he was getting from Brian Hunter were not what the people who did the internal analysis for Deutsche Bank were saying it should have been.
And then he lost $53 million for the bank in just 2 months. You would have thought that would have ended a career on Wall Street forever.
Yes, it ended his career at Deutsche Bank.
Even though he asked for a bonus when they let him go.
He said that he not only asked for a bonus, he sued them for that bonus. He didn't get it. But his argument was that despite the loss, he had made them money, so he deserved it. They moved him out of trading and let him go, basically, because not only had he lost that money, but they were concerned about his attitude. They basically felt he was not mature enough to be a trader. They had questions about these calculations of how much he had won and lost that he was giving them. So he was eased out.
But then he landed on his feet, didn't he?
He left Deutsche Bank at a very good time for him in terms of being an energy trader. Hedge funds were just getting into energy trading. The merchant energy banks like Enron, El Paso, were out of that market. And there was a big vacuum for energy speculation. Hedge funds saw an opportunity. He was a seasoned trader. And Amaranth, the company that I write about, needed another energy trader at that point and hired him.
And then we have, going back to Brian Hunter, he's had this disaster at Deutsche Bank, and yet he winds up at Amaranth. He's at Amaranth. He was questioned extensively by federal investigators, but he winds up setting up his own hedge fund, Centaurus. You would have thought he would have been damaged. But how would you characterize the difference between the two men? Are they very similar? Because they both are major risk takers.
They're both major risk takers, and they both have a propensity to double down if they lose, try to win it back by putting in more money. On that side, I think they're very similar. In terms of how they approach trading, I think they're somewhat different. I think John Arnold is much more relying on actual analysis of supply and demand of the marketplace, and he's much more attuned to the psychology of energy traders.
Did they know each other?
They knew of each other. They certainly knew somewhat of what they were doing. Brian Hunter definitely knew John Arnold, knew of John Arnold, because John Arnold at Enron was the top natural gas trader when he set up his own hedge fund. He was very soon again the top natural gas trader. And people who buy and sell huge quantities of a commodity, there aren't that many of them.
You tell a story about an impending disaster, and then Hurricane Katrina changes everything. Actually, where everybody else suffered, hedge funds did okay.
Well, more than okay. It was Brian Hunter's big win. He had bought up on the cheap, so to speak, options for natural gas before Katrina struck. He was expecting winter prices for the following winter to go up. And he seemed to have been the only one at that point who was expecting high prices. And so options were very cheap. He bought a lot of them, and prices weren't going up. And this was in the summer before the hurricanes. Suddenly Katrina hits, then Rita, the natural gas Nexus points go underwater. They're devastated, and natural gas prices go up enormously. Brian Hunter ends up winning $1 billion, and New Orleans is devastated.
But later, of course, he does all sorts of risky things and brings down his own company. Is there any future for him now? Does he have enough money that he doesn't have to worry about it?
He has a lot of money, but after Amaranth collapsed, within 3 months, he was trying to set up his own hedge fund. The amazing thing was not so much that he was trying to set up his own hedge fund, but that investors were willing to put $800 million together to give to him for that hedge fund.
Barbara Dreyfus's book is Hedgehogs, the Cowboy Traders Behind Wall Street's Largest Hedge Fund Disaster, published by Random House. Thank you so much.
Thank you.